of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, March 17th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Stephen Kinzer on Pakistan in the aftermath of major demonstrations. New Mexico stands on the verge of abolishing the death penalty, and outraged residents protest a private security training facility in Riverside will go live to a demonstration.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A serious standoff between Pakistan's two major political parties has just ended, resulting in a victory for Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif of the Muslim League. Demonstrations in the capital Islamabad turned violent over the weekend as lawyers and their supporters rallied for the reinstatement of Chief Justice Iftikhar Chowdhury, first sacked by former President Pervez Musharraf in 2007. Nawaz Sharif had run for office on a platform of reinstating Chowdhury. His rival, President Asif Ali Zardari of the Pakistan People's Party and widower of Benazir Bhutto, had delayed returning Chowdhury to his old position, ostensibly fearing that the independent-minded judge would revive old corruption charges against him and his wife. In the face of threats to Sharif to attend a major rally on Sunday, police placed the PM under house arrest. But faced with mounting pressure from the streets, as well as Pakistan's strongest ally, the U.S., Zardari reinstated the Chief Justice, and Sharif called off the demonstration. Pakistan's internal turmoil provides a fitting backdrop to the larger issue of fundamentalist violence that earlier this month manifested in a brazen attack on Sri Lanka's national cricket team in Lahore. Joining us this morning to understand what's happening in Pakistan is Stephen Kinzer, award-winning foreign correspondent who has covered more than 50 countries on five continents. He's the author of Overthrow America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq and All the Shah's Men, an American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. He currently writes for the New York Times and teaches journalism and political science at Northwestern University. Welcome to Uprising, Stephen.
Great to be with you.
Thanks very much for joining us. Now, let's talk a little bit about the public pressure and the convergence with Nawaz Sharif. As I mentioned, Nawaz Sharif had his platform based on Chowdhury's return. We've been covering Iftikhar Chowdhury on this program over the years. But what is the alliance, or how do you explain the alliance between the so-called lawyers movement and the civil society in Pakistan and Nawaz Sharif's Muslim League?
I think that alliance is really an alliance of convenience, and I don't see it lasting too long for one important reason. Really, the political elite in Pakistan has no great interest in reinstating not just Chief Justice Chowdhury, but the idea of rule of law. That political elite is profoundly corrupt. Former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is one of the biggest crooks east of Suez, and President Zardari is right up in his league. So if there's an independent judiciary, both of these people have a lot to fear. Now, during the political campaign, naturally, they were both trying to pretend that they like the idea of an independent judiciary because that plays well during a political campaign. But when it comes to really accepting it once you're in office, that's another matter. And I think that's the background to this crisis. It was only because the army commander finally decided to insist that Zardari reinstate this jurist that step was finally taken. So in a sense, a military coup in Pakistan, the military has flexed its muscle, and in this case, it was to strengthen civil society and specifically principle of law.
But still, explain why Nawaz Sharif has taken such a strong stand. If he too could, face any kind of scrutiny by this independent-minded Chief Justice, he went all out. I mean, he broke through the house arrest and was about to attend the rally. And people are calling what happened a couple of days ago a major victory for him.
I think there are a couple of reasons. First of all, Sharif realizes that public sentiment favors the reinstatement of this judge and, by extension, reimposition of the rule of law. As a political figure who's very astute, like any ambitious politician, he wants to ride on the back of public sentiment. So he chose to endorse a policy that is supported by most Pakistani voters. The other reason is that although Sharif has a very shady background and could certainly be the subject of prosecutions in the future, that would probably come later. There are already charges against President Zardari that were suspended or wiped away, at least officially, under the Musharraf period. So that means that those charges can be revived very quickly. It's possible then that both of these corrupt political leaders might ultimately find themselves under legal scrutiny and legal pressure. But if that happens, the one that it would happen to first would be President Zardari.
Now, Nawaz Sharif himself and his brother Shahbaz Sharif are on their eligibility for even holding office is currently being questioned. How does that play into this?
I think that the evolution of the rule of law in Pakistan, as it slowly begins to reestablish itself in the wake of the Musharraf period, is ultimately going to threaten both of those political leaders. In fact, it's probably the most encouraging sign we have on the entire Pakistani political panorama. If that happens, if leaders of the Pakistani political elite begin to fear prosecution for their misdeeds, that will be a great sign that Pakistan is moving ahead and trying to solidify a civil society that is, in the end, its only bulwark against radical extremism.
Let's talk about radical extremism. I mentioned the attack on the Sri Lankan national cricket team earlier in the month. That was a very big news item. Cricket has a very important place in South Asia. What do you think how do you think this current government, this power-sharing government, is going to do about this? I mean, do you think that they can handle what's happening in Pakistan?
I think there are a couple of aspects to that question. First of all, much of the extremist violence in Pakistan actually has its roots in policies that were pursued by the Pakistani authorities and specifically by the ISI, the Pakistani Security Agency, in its desire to try to use whatever tactics are necessary to undermine what it sees as spreading Indian power. The ISI has over the years encouraged a series of violent organizations, and some of those organizations have metastasized and grown into splinter groups that have now come to attack the Pakistani state itself. Now, there's one other very important factor to bear in mind when we look at the prospects for future violence and destabilization in Pakistan, and that is the U.S. policy in Afghanistan. I feel that whatever policy we want to follow in Afghanistan really should be subordinated to our policy toward Pakistan. No result in Afghanistan, no matter how bad it would be as bad as a really bad result in Pakistan. Pakistan poses much greater long-term dangers, partly because of the fact that it's nuclear-armed. Now, as the United States escalates its military presence in Afghanistan, many jihadist militants from other countries who are kind of floating around the world looking for ways to attack Americans and American targets read this news and they say, great, there's 19,000 more targets for us coming to Afghanistan. So these militants then like to converge on Afghanistan in order to escalate the war against American troops. But When they go there, they do not set up camps inside Afghanistan. Their camps are across the border in Pakistan.
In the Northwest Frontier Province?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You have this growing group of Al-Qaeda-oriented militants essentially taking over a slice of Pakistani territory. And, of course, once they get there, they look around Pakistan and they say, gee, this is a country we should try to take over.
But
so by escalating our military forces in Afghanistan, we are attracting militants to Pakistan that pose a profound danger to the stability of that country.
But aren't the Muslim, conservative Muslim forces in Pakistan homegrown?
Yes, but they are not enough to destabilize the Pakistani state. Mm. It is only with the help of this growing group of foreign militants that have been attracted to that region largely by the American presence that there looks like a serious danger to the long-term stability of Pakistan.
So there's an alliance there, is what you're saying?
Absolutely. And in fact, the foreign groups have had the effect of it radicalizing the homegrown Muslim movements in Pakistan. Now, I should add this. Every time I write a column lamenting the terrible fate that awaits Pakistan and Pakistan's imminent collapse into chaos, I do get notes back from some of my Pakistani friends, and they sometimes say, don't go overboard. There's still a strong civil society in this country. There's an overwhelming majority of people in Pakistan that do not want fundamentalist rule and that want to see the reestablishment of civil society. The judiciary is still strong. We have many other institutions in society that are functioning well and defending the rule of law and order.
And so, Pakistan has a very important media, I mean, and a very honest media, relatively speaking.
It's true. Pakistan is a very intriguing blend of some very modern and sophisticated trends with some regions and some political trends that are quite backward. So I don't consider Pakistan at all to be a lost cause. It's a very dangerous situation, but it's not at the point of no return.
Let's go back to what happened over the past few days. Nawaz Sharif's Muslim League Party is not exactly a liberal party. I mean, it's neither is it radical necessarily, but was there some kind of or any kind of alliance with the Muslim leaning groups on the ground and those who are support human rights groups and the lawyers movements around Iftikhar Chowdhury? Is he a figure that has a potential to unite some of the moderate Islamic forces in Pakistan with civil society?
That is a very insightful question. I think you've put your finger on something very interesting, that this lawyers' movement is appealing to a variety of groups. People that are honest and campaigning for good government like this project for obvious reasons, that it's going to fight corruption. Then there are those who want to weaken Zardari, including some who actually don't favor the rule of traditional law over the long run, but see it as a political tool. And this does lead, as you suggest, to the possibility that the judiciary, and maybe even Chief Justice Chaudhry himself, could become increasing factors in Pakistani society. That could become a new focus for possible reforms inside Pakistan.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer, award-winning foreign correspondent. He is well known for his book, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup, and the Roots of Middle East Terror. Also, his book, Overthrow America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. He teaches journalism and political science at Northwestern University. He's just written about Pakistan in the New York Times. Let's talk a little bit about Iftikhar Ali Chowdhury himself, this Chief Justice around whom so much has happened over the past few years. In fact, he is seen as somebody who's very independent-minded, although currently his allegiance, at least according to media reports, is unclear. Where do you think he stands, and is he really as crucial, as important to Pakistani judiciary and civil society as these rallies and demonstrations suggest?
Well, first of all, you say that his political allegiance is unclear. That's true, and I think that's a good thing for a
mm-hmm.
judge. A judge should not have clear political allegiances. That's actually one of the bases of his popularity. Chaudhry himself is an interesting figure because he's different from most Pakistani lawyers. Most of these lawyers are very traditionally British in their formation. And they come from a certain elite and certain schools. Chaudhry isn't like that. He is more of a populist. He comes from a more rural, poorer background in Balochistan. Maybe it was that background that allowed him to take some quite dramatic steps when he was in office. For example, this was not a huge decision in terms of political impact, but symbolically it was great. When he was in office as Chief Justice, he issued a famous ruling that tried to curb the practice of rich Pakistanis throwing these astonishingly expensive weddings for their children. These had really gotten out of hand, in which people would spend tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars on these enormous parties that were really an insult to many ordinary Pakistanis. And Chaudhry tried to use the law as a way to ban this. So with symbolic acts like that, he became kind of a folk hero. Now, I do think that the great support you're seeing behind him now is really not support for him individually alone. It is also support for the idea of an independent judiciary. You have this nice confluence now where not only do people support this principle, but they have an individual who represents this principle, and that's always an easier thing to rally around.
I want to talk about the United States and its involvement. The U.S., of course, as you've mentioned, really cannot, with its war in Afghanistan, do much about Afghanistan without addressing what's happening in Pakistan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has certainly, it seems, played a role in trying to convince Asif Ali Zardari or her staff to give in to the issue of the Chief Justice. What sort of role do you think the United States is currently playing in Pakistan? I mean, not talking about what it should be playing, but what it is actually doing.
I think you're quite right that there was kind of a pincer movement against Zardari in these last days, that the Army commander and the American Secretary of State both sort of coordinated their ultimatums to him, are essentially demanding that he reinstate this Chief Justice. Right now, the United States is trying, I think, very seriously to reassess what it's doing in Pakistan and how it can influence the course of events there. But I think that the Americans are not focusing enough on the effect of their Afghanistan policy inside Pakistan. On the desk of every American diplomat in the world should be a little sign that says, do nothing that will further destabilize Pakistan. Whatever it is and whatever effects it has anywhere else in the world, if a policy is going to destabilize Pakistan, we shouldn't pursue it. So I think we need to look at Pakistan in a much more global sense. The amount of effort that the United States can put in militarily in Pakistan is very limited. I would like to see us trying to pursue a much stronger development angle to our policy in Pakistan, but there's an inherent problem with that we have faced in the past with our development efforts there, and that is corruption. We need to build some kind of a structure so that we know that outside money that comes into Pakistan for development projects is actually going to be used for that. And that, I think, is what lies behind the wise decision by the Americans to pursue this idea of first establishing the rule of law. Once you get that, you can use it as a basis for broader development projects that will try to address real needs of ordinary Pakistanis.
I mean, that a little bit ignores the role that the U.S. has historically played in bringing and preserving dictatorship in Pakistan. It seems disingenuous at best right now that the U.S. might be helping to further democracy. But in any case, it's really the role of the Pakistani civil society and democratic forces to help, you know, the current status quo only get better in terms of democracy. Let me finally ask you to comment on the situation in Swat, in the Swat Valley in Pakistan, where Taliban guerrillas have basically won a major concession for Sharia law. What do you think that does? That a lot of people are looking at that as being the thin end of a very, very dangerous wedge in Pakistan in the direction of a more fundamentalist Islamic law.
I think you're right. I think that is true, and it's a very troubling development. Essentially, the government has surrendered its control over a part of the country, and that undermines the monopoly on coercive force that any stable state must maintain. As a reference to what you just said about the American role, it's very true that Pakistan would not be in this situation
right.
if it were not for years of American intervention. It was the United States, because of our fervent desire to fight the Soviets who were occupying Afghanistan, that essentially turned hundreds of millions of dollars over to the government of Zia-ul-Huq, who was dedicated to two main principles. One was establishing what he called a true Islamic order in Pakistan, and the other was getting a nuclear bomb. We knew that he was doing this, and we decided consciously to help him anyway because we wanted to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. Now, that might have seemed like a good decision at the time, but looking back on it, you can see it as the beginning of much of Pakistan's current trouble.
Hmm. Well, Stephen Kinzer, just briefly as well, we didn't mention this, but it, I think really is worth mentioning. The U.S., in terms of military role, is flying unmanned drones into the Northwest Frontier Province and dropping bombs. It's been doing that for quite some time now, and that, I understand, has started to seriously anger Pakistanis, even those who are outside the Northwest Frontier Province.
The Americans really have to make a decision, and it's the question they have to ask themselves is this. Let's assume that we are achieving some goals and killing some terrorists or militants with these predator attacks. On the other hand, we are also killing civilians, and we are angering huge numbers of people. So we've got to weigh that. Is it worth it? In this kind of war that we're now facing, traditional means of deterrence are not going to work. The way you win a war like the one that's going on in Pakistan and Afghanistan now is to separate the ordinary people from the militants, to isolate the militants, and to get ordinary people to oppose them. But you can't do that as long as you are out killing civilians. In fact, you're doing the opposite. You're providing recruits and more enthusiasm to your enemies. And this is the great contradiction of these drone attacks that have caused so much outrage in Pakistan.
Stephen Kinzer, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Stephen Kinzer, award-winning foreign correspondent. He's covered more than 50 countries on five continents. He's the author of Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, and All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. He currently writes for the New York Times and teaches journalism and political science at Northwestern University. We will link to his article in the New York Times that he recently wrote about Pakistan on our website, kpfk.org/uprising, later today. This is Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll go live to a demonstration in Riverside County against a proposed security training facility. A member of Citizens, or rather the founder of Citizens Against Private Armies, will join us live via cell phone. And after today's subversive historian, we will find out whether New Mexico may be on the verge of banning the death penalty and what you can do about it. Stay tuned.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day, on March 17, 1921, the Red Army began its final assault on Kronstadt, a naval base in the Gulf of Finland. Kronstadt had been a pivotal geographical center of rebellion in Russia in both 1905 and 1917. However, in 1921, it became a point of dissension with the new communist government. Following the end of the Civil War, sailors in Kronstadt had become disaffected by the government's policies, including that of war communism. In response, a general meeting was called aboard the battleship Petro Pavlovsk. It was there that a list of demands was drafted, including free and fair elections of Soviets, freedom of speech for workers, peasants, anarchist and left socialist parties, and the release of political prisoners from those same sectors. The communist authorities characterized the situation in Kronstadt as instigated by bourgeois and foreign agents, and Leon Trotsky ordered its violent suppression. On the other side, Alexander Berkman once wrote, quote, Kronstadt fell, but it fell victorious in its idealism. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
With the swearing of Barack Obama as the 44th president and the beginning of the 111th session of the U.S. Congress, Pacifica Radio takes a hard look at how the new government responds to the economic crisis, global warming, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, foreign policy decisions, healthcare expansion, civil rights, and the so-called war on terrorism. That's Pacifica Radio's daily program chronicling the first 100 days of the Obama administration and the 111th session of Congress. Letters from Washington, the first 100 days, hosted by Mitch Jezerich from the studios of WPFW in Washington, D.C. You can hear Letters from Washington, the first 100 days, weekdays from 12:30 to 1 here on KPFK. That's Monday through Friday, 12:30 to 1.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. On Friday, the New Mexico Senate voted to repeal the state's death penalty law. Governor Bill Richardson has until Wednesday to either sign or veto the bill. If signed by the governor, New Mexico will be the 15th state to abolish the death penalty. The governor's office has set up a phone hotline for the public to register its opinion before the Wednesday deadline. New Mexico last executed an inmate in 2001, the only execution since the reenactment of the death penalty in 1979. There are two men currently on death row whose fate is not clear even if the bill is signed. A death penalty ban would mean that those charged with first-degree murders would face life in prison without the possibility of parole instead of capital punishment. Death penalty opponents are looking at the New Mexico bill with cautious optimism, despite past pronouncements by Richardson that he was in favor of capital punishment. However, proponents such as Colleen Gore, mother of a murdered 9-year-old, oppose repealing the death penalty. According to the Santa Fe New Mexican, Gore said, quote, "I think instead they should be working on ways to shorten the appeals process." My guest is the executive director of the New Mexico Coalition to Repeal the Death Penalty, Vicky Elke. Welcome to Uprising, Vicky.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks very much for joining us today. So New Mexico is clearly not a state that has made necessarily abused the death penalty very much over the last, at least since 1979. As I said, there's only been one execution. Two people remain on death row. It's not Texas, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. And in fact, since 1979, our prosecutors have only filed 211 capital cases in our state. So we are definitely not Texas. And the execution we had in 2001, that person gave up his appeals and fired his attorney and asked the state to put him to death. Otherwise, he would still be on death row facing appeals right now.
So how significant, then, is the action by the Senate to present this bill to Governor Richardson? What led up to it?
Well, we at the Coalition to Repeal the Death Penalty in New Mexico have been working with the Representative Gail Chasey, who is our sponsor on this bill, for the last 10 to 12 years. This is an issue that she has worked tirelessly on, and Representative Chasey, her first year as a legislator, met in an interim committee, some of our members, with Murdered Victims Families for Reconciliation. It's an organization of families who have lost loved ones to murder who oppose the death penalty. And when she met them and realized what the victims' families went through in a death penalty trial and the lack of resources for victims, she told them that she would take this issue on. In fact, she told them that her grandmother lived to be 100 years old so she could handle this issue.
So you're saying that victims, the families of victims actually suffer more in death penalty cases?
Absolutely. A death penalty trial on average is going to, you know, between your appeals and everything else, can last 15 years or more. And the murder victim family members that we work with would much rather go to trial, put the murderer in prison for life without the possibility of parole, and then get back to healing and focus their attention on their loved one. The way it stands right now, all the money, time, resources, media, everything goes into the murderer. And they have said over and over that taking another life is not going to bring their loved one back, and it's just going to beget more violence. And they would rather continue to focus on the loved one they lost.
What about Colleen Gore, who I quoted, who would rather that New Mexico work to shorten the appeals process rather than ban the death penalty?
My heart goes out to her. She lost her beautiful young daughter in a most horrifying way, and I want to make sure everyone knows that the Coalition to Repeal the Death Penalty does not support murderers. We have nothing to do with them. Again, we'd rather them just be put in prison forever. As far as her comment that we should shorten the appeals process, quite frankly, that's a horrifying comment. We work with exonerees who were innocent and spent almost 18 years on death row before they were released. And if we would have hurried up those appeals process, we would have been killing innocent people. Those appeals processes are in place. That's what our Supreme Court did in the 70s when it realized that states were not being constitutional in applying the death penalty laws. So in order for a state to have the death penalty, they have to have those place, those in process. That's a U.S. law. And so quite frankly, that is not an answer to this. Speeding up the appeals process only increases your chance of killing innocent people.
And I understand that the last state execution was the one you were referring to, was the one of the man who was convicted of killing Colleen Gore's daughter, 9-year-old daughter.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So he asked the state to put him to death in the end.
He did. And I think that that is also very telling. We hear that a lot from death row inmates, that there is obviously a high suicide rate on death rows. And there's also, because life in prison, you know, our opponents make it sound like that, you know, they're just hanging out, enjoying life. And, you know, you always hear they've got three meals a day. And I just, you know, I challenge anybody who thinks that it's a picnic to come spend a couple of hours on a level 6 prison here in New Mexico. It's not a picnic.
My guest is Vicky Elke, Executive Director of the New Mexico Coalition to Repeal the Death Penalty. New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson has until this Wednesday to sign the bill that was passed by the Senate, the state Senate. And let's talk a little bit about the governor, Vicky. As I mentioned, he has not necessarily been an opponent of the death penalty. So where does he stand now?
You're absolutely right. In fact, when we had this bill before him, before the Senate 2 years ago, he made it clear that he would not sign it if it got to his desk. But there's been a lot of things that have happened in the last 2 years. First of all, we've had our first state in the country to repeal the death penalty since it was reinstated in the 70s, and that was New Jersey in December of 07. We've had 6 other countries that have abolished the death penalty in those 2 years, and we know a lot more now about how it's such a bad public policy, how it doesn't work, how we have 130 people who've now been exonerated from death row since the 70s, and I tell everybody, those are the lucky ones. We don't know. Those are the ones that had family and friends and attorneys who actually cared about them and pushed for years. So we have lots of new information that we've shown the governor. We've met with the governor. He had open office hours yesterday afternoon, and half of the people there to talk to him were people who were asking him to repeal the death penalty. So we think that the governor is very open to this issue. He has stated publicly that he's struggling and wants to do the right thing.
So let's talk also about the hotline then. What is this hotline? How many people have been using it? And feel free to give out the number.
Absolutely. They have said that...
Is this something the governor set up on his own?
It is. It's something the governor set up on his own on Friday after we had the vote. His office issued a press release asking people to contact the governor and let them know, you know, how do they feel about this? And, you know, how do they feel about this? What is going on? You know, what can we do? And... So he wanted to hear from everybody.
And have people been calling?
People have. We heard yesterday that he's gotten over 6,000 phone calls and emails about it.
I have a number in front of me here. Correct me if I'm wrong. The hotline for Governor Richardson's that he has put out asking for comments on the New Mexico bill to abolish the death penalty is 505-476-2225, 505-476-2225.
Yes, that's exactly it. And, you know, and he has put out that press release around the world. He has not just asked for New Mexico opinions on this. So he distributed that press release worldwide. So we're asking everybody who supports repealing the death penalty to give him a call or drop him a line and let him know how they feel.
Now, Vicky, I mentioned that the two men who are currently on death row in New Mexico, their fate is not clear if this ban were to pass. Who would decide their fate?
You know, that's a very interesting question that a lot of people have been concerned about. Obviously, this bill, if it passes, is not retroactive like any criminal law passed in New Mexico. So it would not affect anybody currently on death row. And that is something that I think will be up to the courts as well as the governor, and to find out if we abolish the death penalty in New Mexico, is there public support for still continuing an execution? And that's something we just don't know at this point.
So it would be up to the courts to take up the individual cases and decide whether or not to grant clemency or commute the sentences.
Right.
So, Vicky, I mentioned, and I think you mentioned as well, that this is a growing movement around the country. New Mexico, if Governor Richardson signs the bill, would be the 15th state in the country to abolish the death penalty. And this has all happened in a short time. California is also considering it and has had commissions on the issue. But it was only a few decades ago that the trend toward the death penalty had swept across the country. Now we're seeing a reversing of that trend. What do you think has contributed to that?
Well, actually, I just want to make one clarification there. We would not be the 15th state to repeal the death penalty. We would be the second state to repeal the death penalty. 12 states never reinstated the death penalty after the 70s.
Okay.
New Jersey did repeal it, and New York, actually, it was through their courts that they found that the death penalty was unconstitutional.
So it would be the 15th state where the death penalty was not used.
So we would be the actual second state to repeal it legislatively since 1965.
Thank you for that clarification.
Sure. And I think that there's a lot of reasons. Like you say, we have got numerous states across the country that are looking at this. I mean, an abolition bill has already passed the state Senate in Montana. Nebraska is looking at it. Kansas had a hearing yesterday in their Senate. You know, we've got so many different states. Like you said, California, Colorado is looking at it. And I think that one of the reasons this year that everybody is really looking at it is what we call the dirty little secret of the death penalty is that it costs more than life in prison.
And it costs more to execute somebody than to keep them in prison for the rest of their life.
Absolutely. And, in fact, there have been numerous studies done in California and many other states that show that. With a death penalty trial, it is you've got two separate trials to begin with. You've got a guilt or innocence trial, and then you have a trial to say death penalty or not. Hmm. It takes, on average, 1,000 jurors to get a 12, you have to interview 1,000 jurors to find 12 that are what they call death penalty qualified. And
meaning so, people who haven't necessarily made up their mind one way or another?
Somebody who can say to them, yes, I can execute somebody. Yes, I can vote for that. And, I mean, if you put someone in prison, life without the possibility of parole, you, on average, that a life without parole case is about 37 years. That's the average of how long they're going to live. And if you look at that number times the amount that it costs them per year to keep them there, you're looking at about $750,000. But if you do a death penalty trial, it includes all of your trial proceedings. It includes your pre-sentencing investigations. You have to do a bunch of psychology exams. You're talking about an average of 14 years on death row at a higher cost because death row is more expensive than life in prison because you have all different kinds of procedures put in there. And so you're talking about instead of $750,000, you're now up to over $2 million. Mm-hmm. And I like to let everybody know that the majority of that cost is in the trial phase. It's not in the appeals phase. About 80% of those costs are in the trial phase. We have a representative here, a state representative, Mo Maestas from Albuquerque, who used to work as a prosecutor in the Bernalillo County Public District Attorney's Office. And he said that when he was there, they had their two very best prosecutors working on one of our death penalty cases for 2 years. That's all they did. And he said if they were instead working on other cases, they could have put away 400 violent criminals in that 2 years instead of working on a death penalty case that still got, you know, another 10 years before it's even resolved.
And just on the issue of seeing more and more states considering banning the death penalty, there's also the increasing use of DNA evidence that has exonerated, as you've said, over 100 people, which I think has maybe caused more questioning in the national scene. More people to think about, you know, the fact that we might be executing innocent people is a very scary and horrific thing.
It's a very scary thing. And it actually, those 130 people, only 15 of them were exonerated. exonerated through DNA.
Hmm.
The other ones were, it had all to do with prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct, and eyewitnesses lying. So that's another, you know, that's something that legislators are looking at. I mean, DNA is only available in about 10% of all murder cases.
Depending on the evidence available. Right.
And so, you know, the idea that we have DNA now that's going to, you know, be our magic bullet is a little scary because we don't actually have DNA in most of these cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it's because of people making mistakes.
Well, Vicki, would you like to give it a website for your organization?
Absolutely. It's nmrepeal.org.
That's nmrepeal.org. That's the website for the New Mexico Coalition to Repeal the Death Penalty. Also, once more, the hotline that Governor Richardson has set up until tomorrow. Tomorrow is the last day he'll be taking comments about repealing the death penalty. That is 505-476-2225, 505-476-2225. We'll also list that number as well as link to Vicki's website on our site, kpfk.org/uprising, later today. Vicki Elke, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Vicki Elke is the executive director of the New Mexico Coalition to Repeal the Death Penalty. Again, nmrepeal.org as a site. This is Uprising, and after a short break, we'll go live to a demonstration happening right now in Riverside County against a proposed security training facility. Stay tuned.
KPFK. We've made our goal of $1 million during this winter fund drive. This is one of the most generous listenerships in America.
What you did really was invest into this community resource.
When I'm in a fund drive and I say that this place is precious to me, it's not just words. KPFK is precious.
We'll always be the place where ideas are put forward about creating a more just society and creating social transformation.
You had a home run for us, as usual. I'm so proud to be part of this family. I just love you all so much, and thank you so much.
Really and truly, because the way that you selflessly came together to support this radio station in this immensely challenging economic moment, it's extraordinary.
Gratitude, gratitude, gratitude.
Again, on behalf of KPFK, Pacifica, to our listeners, a giant heartfelt thank you.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Gohatkar. A private company named Prosync2 is facing increasing opposition to its plans to construct a security training facility in Riverside County. Former Navy SEAL and Prosync2 founder John Choate wants to transform 194 acres of property in the town of Homeland into a multi-million-dollar center complete with a driving track, gymnasium, and indoor-outdoor firing ranges. Slated to be dubbed The Ranch, the private for-profit company purports that its training services would be reserved for government, police, and military personnel. When the Riverside County Board of Supervisors approved the plan to construct the facility more than a year ago, this claim was used to deem it an educational institution. Under such a definition, board members issued Prosync2 a public use permit and expedited the process under a fast-track authorization that it would normally not have been entitled to. Criticizing the actions as improper, concerned residents have organized against the establishment of the security training facility. A protest outside the Riverside County Administrative Office is taking place as we speak and is demanding the approval of the training center be revoked. Joining us live on the line via cell phone is the founder of Citizens Against Private Armies, Ann Weston. Welcome to Uprising, Ann.
Well, thank you very much, Sonali.
Thanks very much for joining us today. First, tell us in your words why you are where you are today. Why are you protesting Prosync2?
We're protesting against Prosync2 because it is a private for-profit army, and it has a public use permit, which is just not compatible with the area. It should, and as a result, it needs to be stopped. And we're concerned about the different things that will be happening there. We're concerned about the safety issue. We're concerned about the noise issue. We're concerned about the laws that they've broken.
And how many people are at the protest right now? How is this? And is this the first of several protests, or is this something that's been ongoing?
Well, there's about 20 people here right now. We're all dressed in red, white, and blue and carrying signs that say, you know, Precinctu must go, Precinctu no private armies, et cetera, et cetera. We've been involved in this for, well, nearly a year. I started collecting all of the papers from the public records, and I copied them off. Then I filed them naturally, and I've been studying them. And people started jumping on as a result once they found out what's happening. One of them was Paul Jacobs, who is a columnist for the Californian, and he's written about 5 or 6 columns. At first he thought I was probably just being overreacting, but he realized I wasn't.
Now, is it just that the process was fast-tracked that you have a problem with, or the actual facility itself?
The facility itself, it's not compatible with the area. And that's one of the things you're supposed to have with a public use permit. Only there in that area you're supposed to be able to have educational uses, which it's not because it's not listed in the project description. You're able to have hospitals, government uses, educational institutions, social services, and things like that. And it was brought in under the wire by illegal waivers, and we found out what is happening up there, and we feel as though it should be stopped. A few of the people there, the Blackwater instructors, there are 3, which are listed in private papers, which I found, and that was in a paper that was called the Naval Security Warfare.
So you're saying that there are instructors who are supposed to be teaching at this facility when it's built that are employees of Blackwater, the company formerly known as Blackwater, which is gained a lot of fame in Iraq for essentially providing a mercenary army?
Right, and now named Z. And the Blackwater instructors are listed there. It looks like a duck, as you want to say, acts like a duck, and walks like a duck. Mm-hmm. And they are teaching the same things as found in Blackwater. I've read Jeremy Scahill's book, and I really can't see any difference between the two.
Now, what are some of your most important concerns about the facility itself, and notwithstanding the fact that it's been sort of mislabeled an educational institution to fast-track it through, but the facility itself, I mean, I can imagine sort of indoor-outdoor firing ranges not being something terribly popular with residents.
Well, one of them is the lack of an EIR and a public review process of this training facility, which means that there is a possibility that depleted uranium weapons and phosphorus could be used, which would increase the pollution of air, soil, and water, and that would affect the community.
So the environmental review is something that's still, that there's no environmental review planned?
No, there was no environmental review planned, and instead they decided to do a mitigated negative declaration, which means they really didn't do too much.
Now, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying, and then other serious risks with this combat training center include severe fire danger to surrounding communities, and they're going to plant highly volatile trees, such as eucalyptus trees and then also California trees. And then they're going to have the shooting ranges. There are 9 inside, 1 outside, outdoor live fire, which is not allowed because, again, it's not in the project description. It has to be in there. Besides, they're going to have simulated weapons such as bombs, grenades, rockets, and not just limited to those. All of this being allowed, and since it's a private corporation, we don't have the right to ask for records or review the site to make sure that. And then Commissioner Roth asked the planning department and said, is there any way that we can make sure that everything is going okay? And the planning department answered, this is the response. The conditions do not require revisiting the permit shy of the permit life, which is 20 years.
20 years.
20 years.
So that's how long they can basically sit on this, use this permit or keep it in order to make the facility. My guest is Ann Weston. She's the founder of Citizens Against Private Armies. She's joining us live right now from a demonstration happening in front of the Riverside County Administrative Office against the proposed security training facility called Precinctu. The founder of this facility, former Navy SEAL John Choate, said in a Press Enterprise article on the issue of Blackwater, and he said in this Press Enterprise article that only one of his instructors was employed at Blackwater and that it's just not a big deal. How do you respond to his characterization of his company's ties to Blackwater?
Well, he said that he didn't have so I started using the word that he does have ties, because I found in private papers that were probably never to have been in the public records itself. And one of them is called Naval Special Warfare Group 1. But one of these Blackwater's instructors will teach prisoner detaining, prisoner handling, and sniper training, along with other combat readiness skills.
So wait, say that again. So where did you read this again?
And it's proprietary papers that were made out to the Naval Special Warfare Group 1. It was a proposal to them in order to start having part of the Navy people coming up to train on this property.
And it's interesting because, of course, in light of our new president, the announcement by the Justice Department that there will be no such thing as enemy combatants anymore, this sort of thing is still going on, particularly in our local communities. I want to take a step back, Anne, and talk a little bit about your organization, Citizens Against Private Armies. You said that you've been doing this organizing for about a year right now. When did you first learn about Precinctus Project? And, you know, what I'm assuming that this is that this sort of activism is something new to you?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, I would call myself an accidental activist. I've always been looking for a cause. You know, I knew there was more to life than just gardening. But I happen to, I read everything that has to do with current events. And I happened to read about Precincto back in March or April of last year. And then I heard Ray Lutz speaking on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and he mentioned about Blackwater West, which was down there in Potrero, and then at that time he mentioned they could be coming up north, and I thought, oh my gosh, that would be Precincto, because I had read one article.
And tell our listeners who Ray Lutz is exactly.
Oh yes, Ray Lutz is from Potrero, and he, with a group of activists, were able to oust Blackwater West from Potrero again, as in San Diego County. And since he met me, what I did is I took all the notes down to him, or not one a page, describing what was happening. And he said, Anne, that crossed my radar too, but I didn't know who to contact, and I'm so busy down here removing Blackwater West that I couldn't do anything. And then he's been with me ever since on computers and everything else and guiding me and whatever. He's one of my heroes.
So you've managed to try to replicate what he has done in San Diego County up in Riverside County. I understand Ray is with you at the protest right now?
Oh, yes, he is. Yes, he is, Sonali.
That's
really nice.
And what about what you plan now in the future after this demonstration, assuming it may get some attention? I mean, the local press has been covering it, but what are your future plans for your group, Citizens Against Private Armies, in pursuing this? How far are you willing to go?
Well, what's happened right now, Sonali, which is very interesting, we sent in a resolution against Precincto right here at the Riverside Democratic Central Committee, and it was passed. And then I sent that out to everyone else. Since then, two more clubs have written resolutions and had them approved. One is in Palm Springs, and the other one is in San Bernardino. Another one is also just told me last night that they're going to a meeting, and they're going to see about one passing. So this is something that we're going to pursue. We have other things to do also, Sonali, but some of it's strategy and things like that. So, I mean, if you understand, I'm sure you understand.
So yeah. You've managed to activate a lot of people in your community around this?
Yes, and it was, and more and more. Finally, people have joined from Homeland and Romaland. They put up signs and everything, and so it is growing. It's just, it took a while. One person, I just kept talking and talking about it, and that's where I am right now. But it's gone. It's reaching a point where it's taking off.
Well, if others want to join you, support you, particularly those living in and around Riverside County or outside even, how can they get in touch with you?
They can go to the site Citizens Against Private Armies, www.citizensagainstprivatearmies.org. is one way that they can help, and they can call my number 1-951-764-8512.
764-8512?
Yes.
In the 951 area code. And yes, we will put that information on our website later today as well, kpfk.org/uprising. Well, with a website, you're certainly on your way to becoming a professional activist. And I want to congratulate you on the work that you have done. Best of luck to you and your fellow protesters as you continue your demonstration this morning.
Well, thank you very much.
And do you want to briefly give out an address in case there are people right in the area that are listening that want to join you?
And let's see, an address.
That where you are at right now, the Riverside County Administrative Office?
Oh, yes. It's at 4080 Lemon Street.
4080
Lemon Street, right down in Riverside at the Riverside County Administration Building, where the Riverside County Board of Supervisors will have their general meeting starting, well, we're going in at 10 o'clock.
Okay. Well, 4080 Lemon Street in Riverside. Ann Weston, best of luck to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, there, Ann Weston and her fellow demonstrators are currently at 4080 Lemon Street in Riverside, outside the Riverside County Administrative Office, to protest the plan for a proposed security training facility that called Procinctu, which has been fast-tracked by the Riverside Board of Supervisors. Well, again, the website, by the way, citizensagainstprivatearmies.org. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Oscar Wilde once said, agitators are a set of interfering, meddling people who come down to some perfectly contented class of the community and sow the seeds of discontent among them. That is the reason why agitators are so absolutely necessary. Without them in our incomplete state, there would be no advance towards civilization. That's Oscar Wilde, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. You can get a CD of today's program by contacting the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230, or you can go online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Jesse Wood and Deirdre Boykin are our interns. Nadia Richardson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this show after 10 a.m. today at our website, kpfk.org/Uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and see you tomorrow at 8.